Good morning, Grant.
Morning, how are you?
Good. I'm Sarah Posner, senior editor at Religion Dispatches, and I'm here today with Grant Galicho, who's associate editor at Commonweal Magazine. And we are going to talk about the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and the Religious Liberty Campaign, along with the Vatican crackdown on the religious order of nuns in the United States. I'll just sort of backtrack a little bit and give a little background on all of these sort of intersecting campaigns and events that have been going on within the leadership of the Catholic Church in the United States. Last year, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops launched a religious liberty campaign and formed an ad hoc committee on religious liberty, which has put out statements, testified before Congress, led the charge against the Department of Health and Human Services contraception mandate, and most recently issued a kind of call to action over the summer for Catholics to rise up and protest these alleged infringements of religious liberty by the government and by our culture. And somewhat simultaneously with this was this announced crackdown on the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, which is somewhat of a continuation of an investigation that was already in place. And maybe you can give us a little bit more detail on how all of that came about and what prompted it.
Sure. In 2008, it was announced that the Vatican was going to conduct two investigations. So one of those investigations was going to look at the quote-unquote quality of life of nuns in this one particular body it's this umbrella group that covers about 90% of U.S. nuns called the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. It just rolls off the tongue. So they decided that they were going to send Vatican representatives and working in concert with U.S. bishops and in concert with the LCWR to investigate what life like a nun in the United States is. So at the same time, the Vatican announced that they would be looking at the doctrine that these issues of beliefs as practiced by these orders of nuns. So that's actually a separate investigation. So what's been decided now is the end result of the doctrinal investigation.
Okay.
The study of their quality of life is forthcoming. It's referred to in the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith's report, and that's the Vatican office.
Right, and that's the Vatican office that Pope Benedict, back when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, headed up.
Right. It used to be the Office of the Inquisition.
Right.
This is a cuddlier version of that.
There can be a cuddlier version of the Inquisition.
Yeah. I mean, this is the doctrinal watchdog office, basically. So this is the same office that has produced reports looking at theologians, liberation theologians especially, priests mainly, so this doctrinal element is being handled by the CDF.
So, you know, one of the phrases that popped out of the report that came out last week, it would be called a report, the one that came out of the CDF, was this concern that the Vatican was expressing about the nuns' embrace of what they called radical feminism. What's going on here? This is just basically...
Yeah, this is.
Is there something more political going on here in addition
political,
to
I don't
something
know.
Within
I mean,
Catholicism?
You know, there's certainly, I mean, you know, there's no mystery that the church, that the institutional church, the leadership of the church, has a serious problem when it comes to women in leadership roles. I mean, that's not, and that's even separate from the question of whether the institutional church believes that it can ordain women. It believes that it cannot.
Right. And so the nuns are not considered clergy.
No, they're actually lay women who have made certain promises of celibacy and poverty and obedience to their religious superiors. This is an ongoing issue inside the church. The way that the institutional church has responded to advancements in Western societies, especially understanding of women and women's rights and their faculties, et cetera. I mean, if you look at the old Catholic Encyclopedia, the entry on women, this is the 1917 edition, is pretty retrograde. I mean, it talks about women as submissive to, you know, the will of their husbands, et cetera, and all that kind of that way of thinking about women we would consider totally outmoded. So this doctrinal investigation found. And it looked at all kinds of things. It looked at publications that the individual religious orders use to educate their postulants. It looked at speeches given at conferences. It looked at handouts. It looked at a whole range of things, a lot of which is available online, actually. And it concluded two things. One was that there was a problem of positive error. So, and this is where the radical feminism comes in. These investigators found that there was an undue emphasis on feminism at the exclusion of certain traditional understandings of God, of clergy, of tradition, et cetera, et cetera. This is something that also came out a few months ago when the U.S. bishops launched their critique of Beth Johnson's work. Beth Johnson is a theologian who works at Fordham. She's a sister of St. Joseph. And what came out in their critique of her book was, it was actually quite dramatic, but one of the areas that they focused on was her feminist theology. And they very tendentiously argued that she was pressing for feminine images of God at the exclusion of masculine images, which is simply false.
What are the consequences of this report for the lives of these nuns?
Rome has appointed the Archbishop of Seattle, I believe his name is pronounced Seton, but I could have that wrong, who has a reputation for being pretty moderate. And so he has been appointed this delegate, this apostolic delegate, and he has a pretty wide-ranging authority. He, according to this report from the CDF, he has the authority to rewrite the statutes, that sort of the bylaws of the LCWR. I'm not sure if he also has the authority to go into the individual religious orders, religious communities, and you know, restructure their organization. I'm not sure about that. He has the authority to approve speakers that are invited to conferences. He can there's a training book that is pulled out of circulation as a result of this report, and he's going to be able to edit it, rewrite it.
And a training booklet, training for what?
Training postulants. You know, this is the, mm-hmm. the spirituality courses
right.
that you know, this is how members of community form themselves, mm-hmm. Is the way Catholics put it. So it's interesting that there was a cover letter that the guy who runs the CDF, Cardinal Leveda, he put out this statement, a one-page statement, but he kept emphasizing that this was a collaboration. So you can tell, and the fact that Rome appointed a bishop who has a reputation as pretty moderate, I think says that they understand that this is not going to go over that well with these women religious.
Right. Or with rank and file Catholics.
Yes. There's a Twitter campaign right now. I forget what the hashtag is, but it's sort of like.
There are a couple of Twitter campaigns. There's one, I think there was started by Father James Martin. And I can't remember what the hashtag is. There's another one. The hashtag is Radical Feminist Themes, I think, which was started by, Occupy Catholics.
Is that right? Yes. You know, people like me.
Not that Twitter is the sum total of, Catholics on Twitter is not the sum total of what Catholics
no,
in America
but
think.
This isn't, you know, right, no, but this isn't 5 years ago either. I mean, you're seeing it on
right,
Facebook
right.
too. It's very mainstream. And I think most Catholics who spent time in religious education have, you know, had contact with nuns. You know, these are the women.
Right, of course.
People like me. I'm a Chicago guy, so the Catholic Church there still had a very. It's not as robust as it was. But when I was a kid, I had nuns.
Right.
They were not habited. Which, you know, I'm a Vatican II kid, so mm-hmm. I didn't think twice about it.
Right.
But so yeah, we all have relatively positive experiences with these women, and even if you want to discount for the tales of, you know, rulers being used in ways they weren't designed for. There's still just the fact of what these women do.
Right.
They have taken vows of poverty. They have agreed not to marry. They live in community. They are the ones who built the Catholic infrastructure in this country. I mean, without them, there would be no Catholic schools. Without them, there'd be no Catholic hospitals. So, you know, that this is a point that's been made by other people, including Scott Appleby, who's a Notre Dame.
I was about to bring that up because I had seen that you posted that video on your blog.
I mean, he makes a very good argument. I mean, it's not that
he described it as inappropriate and humiliating.
He did.
That
and,
the Vatican would investigate
right,
the nuns in this way.
He makes the point, which is persuasive, that the way that this document has come down from the CDF, it treats these women as though they're school children.
Well, that's the idea,
I mean,
right?
These are women who democratically elect their own leadership. Much like the way the Pope is democratically elected. Bishops, not so much, but leadership of religious congregations and the Pope, there's some democracy there. And so even though these women have voted for their leadership, they now have someone who's being installed by the outside, being installed by Rome, who will have pretty sweeping authority over the very constitutions of their organizations. That's why Appleby, I think, rightly called it humiliating.
Right. Well, to look at it a different way, Sister Simone Campbell, who works with this organization Network, told, I think, the Washington Post or USA Today, she said, I think we scare them.
Right.
So that's kind of another way of looking at it, that they're a threat to the Catholic hierarchy in some way, either doctrinally or politically.
There's a point in the Vatican document where the LCWR is criticized for failing to agree with bishops on matters of, it's, I forget what the wording is, it's like on matters of morals, you know, faith and morals, which is, you know, the bishop's teaching arena, mm-hmm. but it's also on bishop's public positions. And that's the word that appears in the CDF document. I immediately thought of the healthcare debate and the way that the Catholic Health Association, which is run by Sister Carolpeen, publicly opposed, and not in any kind of aggressive way, but they simply stated that when it, and this happened during the healthcare debate too, that their public policy interpretation or their interpretation of the way the law was written did not conform to USCCB statements.
Right.
And
well, let's revisit that, just because I think the details are somewhat important. In because back when the what became the Affordable Care Act was being debated in Congress, there was the notorious Stupak Amendment, which was designed to prevent the use of any federal funds going to pay for anyone's abortion, even though the Hyde Amendment already prohibits that.
Elective abortions,
And there was already an amendment drafted by Congressman Lois Capps that sort of reiterated that for the purposes of the Healthcare Reform Act, the Healthcare Reform Bill. But the Stupak Amendment went further in terms of wanting to ban the use of the participation in the exchange by insurance companies that offered abortion otherwise, even though they didn't offer coverage to the people participating in the exchange. So eventually what happened when the bill hit the Senate, there was sort of a somewhat watered down version of the Stupak Amendment that got put in and eventually was part of the final bill, because it was part of the final bill in large part, because the Catholic Health Association said, yes, that's fine. It's okay. We're fine with that. We're fine with the whoever it was, Nelson and Casey Amendment. Mm-hmm. But the bishops continued to oppose it. But the fact that the Catholic Health Association gave political cover, their approval gave political cover to the Democrats.
Right.
That they could say, look, the Catholic Health Association says this is okay, that there's no federal funding for abortion in this bill, and we really want to get health care reform passed, and Sister Keehan is, you know, saying this is okay. That gave the Democrats a lot of cover. And then another time, you know, after Obama made the accommodation on the contraception coverage requirement this February, just a couple of months ago, again, it was Sister Keehan who essentially gave the political cover and said, yes, we're okay with this, even though the bishops continue to fight it and still continue to fight it now.
Yeah.
And so you can't help if you follow politics, help but see the connection
between. You can also see a very similar strategy from the bishops' conference. One of our bloggers noted that during the healthcare debate, when it came to the question of abortion, all of the statements coming out of the USCCB had this kind of worst case scenarioism that was animating all of the opposition, and to Stupak, even to the executive order that Stupak got the president to sign. There were increasingly baroque these scenarios that the bishops' conference was floating, that even if you kiss my foot, no erases, there's going to be no federal funding of elective abortions, even if the president says that even just federal credits for health plans in the state exchanges, that because that could free up cash that a woman might use to pay for an elective abortion, that was enough to oppose even that executive order that satisfied Stupak and which eventually cost him his seat. I mean, Stupak felt betrayed. You know, he wrote about this. He said that he felt people at the bishop's conference stopped returning his calls, and he went from hero to enemy of the pro-life movement. The more organized versions like the NRLC and the American Life League, which is relatively new. So there's that worst case scenario thinking during the Affordable Care Act, and now what you're seeing in the bishop's response to even the accommodation is the same sort of thinking. You know, what if this? You know, I mean, and it's what's interesting for me is the way that the Obama administration has really responded. So you know, you've got the first version of the contraception mandate, which Commonweal opposed, which I opposed. Then there was the accommodation, which broke away the funding of contraception care, and also the direct, you didn't have to contract for services that would be inimical to your religious belief. So that was completely separated from health coverage and from the coverage that was being purchased by the employer.
That the employer provider, the employer provides to the employees, right?
And so at every turn, the Bishops' Conference has interpreted even the accommodation as, if you look at the way that the exemption is structured, it's going to, permeate all kinds of federal laws. You know, you can't say that just because that the only religious employer is the parish and the parish school. That's not how Catholics view their ministries. They view, Catholic hospitals as an expression of following Christ's teachings. So that was one of the critiques. So the most recent thing that came out of HHS that's in the federal registry now is this,
which is the proposed rulemaking based on the accommodation
that
Obama made on February 10th.
Yeah. So I mean, if you can plow through the regulatory language, it's brutal. But you can see the Obama administration tying itself in knots, trying to respond to the bishop's concerns. And one of the things that this proposed rulemaking states outright is that nothing in the HHS regs can be construed as any kind of precedent for other federal laws. This is only about contraception. That's what
right,
HHS is
saying. Right.
But that's still not good enough.
So, you know, you mentioned that you opposed the original rule that came out on January 20th. And did you think that the accommodation adequately addressed the concerns, your concerns, if not the bishop's concerns?
Yeah. I mean, my major concern from a Catholic moral theological point of view was the level of cooperation. That's how Catholics talk about this stuff. So
right.
if you
so that you that the that the religious institutions would be somehow involved in providing the coverage for the
right.
contraception.
And I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on Catholic stuff, but you know the Catholic moral tradition has shock absorbers. So it doesn't it recognizes that our world is not perfect and that it's damn near it's not really possible to commit morally pure acts. That we're always involved in some kind of structural sin.
Right.
So it developed
these
categories.
Especially we offer taxes to the government.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So it's the bananas we eat are picked by people whose fingers are stunted by that work. So I mean, it's that kind of thinking. So the tradition developed these categories where, in order to help us think through forms of cooperation with evil, as the Catholic theology holds, that would be acceptable. So
what do you think is behind the bishops? And they did this with the healthcare reform and the abortion coverage, and they're doing it with the contraception coverage. This very sort of hyper-technical parsing of the statutory or regulatory language. There's that piece of it, and there's also the piece of it where, like you said, this sort of parade of horribles, this never-ending slippery slope, that that this is going to cause this precedent or that precedent, or lead to this thing or that thing, or lead to this terrible requirement imposed by the government on religious institutions, getting in the way of their ability to just be themselves, be what they're supposed to be. Do you think that these are legitimate, genuinely, sincerely believed, genuinely held concerns by the bishops? Or is this a political game that they're playing? Because it's hard to see. I think it's even hard for Catholics to see, as you were just discussing. It's even hard for Catholics to see the value in this, for lack of a better word, nitpicking over this stuff.
Well, I mean, if there's one thing Catholicism is good at, it's nitpicking.
But
I think what's strange, and you just got into something that boggles my mind, is why do we see such careful parsing, such slippery slope, very, very detail-oriented analysis of the Affordable Care Act statute, of these regulations coming out of HHS, when the Catholic tradition itself provides pretty robust equipment to help Catholics think through these moral issues. But we haven't, and this has been one of, this has been the axe that I've been grinding on Commonwealth blog, when are we going to see a Catholic argument from a Catholic bishop about this stuff? And we really haven't seen one. We've seen, and which is okay. I mean, one of the things that the Catholic Church teaches is that many of its moral teachings, or its moral teachings are accessible to non-Catholics, through natural law. We haven't even seen a kind of natural law argument, except when it comes to something like, gay marriage. But here in this particular case, I find it very strange. And I don't know, I think most bishops just want to, do the work of their dioceses. They want to teach, govern, and sanctify in their local diocese. And I don't know, I don't know that most bishops are really interested in getting involved in a national campaign like the one that's being called for by the ad hoc committee on religious freedom.
But there are bishops who seem very interested in it.
You've seen some of them
talk about it very publicly. You've seen the bishop in Chicago whose name is now...
you're thinking of the Peoria guy, Bishop Jenkins.
The Peoria guy, right, the one who compared Obama to Hitler and Stalin. And then you have the Archbishop of Philadelphia talking about how, yes, this religious freedom thing is about to, come down on us in this very terrible, unprecedented way. And then even non-bishops in Catholic organizations, I'm thinking of the Knights of Columbus speech last week at the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast, which, again, portrayed some of these policy events as the most dire threat to religious freedom that we've ever seen.
Right. And,
I just wonder, how does that hyperbole really play with, you're saying that it doesn't even play with their fellow bishops?
Well, I mean, I'm just speculating about, but I do think, I mean, the bishop conference is made up of a lot of different kinds of people.
Right. 270 something bishops, right? Something like that.
Sorry?
270
yes, and that,
something
yes,
bishops.
And that includes the auxiliary bishops in addition to the bishops and archbishops of various dioceses. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, this would never happen, but it would be really interesting to get a poll of the bishops to see what they make of this national campaign. You've seen the statement, the most recent statement out of the ad hoc committee, I think has tried to address some of the more prominent critiques of the original statement. So you see that they're starting to list other impingements on religious freedom.
Right. They talk about the immigration statutes, and they single out Alabama's.
Right. And they talk about that crazy Connecticut bill that wasn't going anywhere and didn't go anywhere that would have allowed the state basically would have decided how to incorporate and structure individual parishes. That was a direct response.
That is hardly that bill that went nowhere in Connecticut is hardly a trend.
No, it's not. And even the Alabama law, which I would like to see fail. I'd like to see it overturned by the Supreme Court, which has agreed to hear it.
Yes, it's terrible.
But
obviously,
but some of the most objectionable things in that bill were already overturned by Alabama State Court. So some of the things in the bishop's most recent, some of the complaints about the law for basically criminalizing Catholic ministries, seems to me those have already been addressed. And
they weren't. The bishops in their original, the ad hoc committee's original statements and original testimony before Congress, I think it was the House Judiciary Committee last year, and then again, Bishop Lurie testified a few times in relation to the contraception mandate. But those original statements did not bring in these concerns about the immigration, and I'm pretty sure that they didn't even bring in the Hosanna Tabor issue into the discussion.
That was a pretty early strategy that they identified, yeah.
Okay, but the immigration thing was new, it was in direct response to criticism that they were only concerned about issues relating to abortion, contraception,
right.
Same-sex marriage.
But there was one other piece that they added into the most recent statement, which was the long-awaited acknowledgement that religious freedom issues in other parts of the world actually result in the deaths of people.
Right.
So, that's not what... this was something that was brought up by the America Magazine editorial that, when you talk about the contraception mandate as though I think Cardinal Mahoney wrote that he could think of no more dramatic theft of religious freedom. He said something like that. Well, no, you can think of being murdered for your religious belief. I mean, that would be, which actually is happening right now in certain parts of the world.
Right.
So, it's good to see that, this ad hoc committee is at least responding to some of the critiques that has been made.
Even though they did, they still bring up, Reformation era hostility to Catholics and to compare it to the martyrs and saints. It's just the hyperbole is just, I have a hard time understanding why that sort of hyperbole is okay. Yet this alleged, radical feminism, by the nuns is somehow the reason to investigate them and crack down on them and have this whole doctrinal, crackdown on the nuns. It's so, to an outsider, and I'm not Catholic, obviously, but to an outsider, it just seems so, everything is out of proportion in terms of their rhetoric on the religious freedom thing, and then on the flip side of that, their rhetoric about what's allegedly wrong with the nuns is also on the hyperbolic end of things.
Well, although the CDS statement is much more careful, actually, even if you don't agree with the radical feminism critique.
Okay.
It does spend time lauding nuns for the work that they've, quoting John Paul II, who wrote some very beautiful compliments. I mean, and it shows a little bit, I think, a little more careful thinking in terms of optics, although the timing of it is not great. I mean, it's like...
Right. I mean, that was, I think, what struck me, because I've been covering the religious freedom campaign and the HHS mandate and all of that, and the timing just seems so shockingly tone deaf.
Well,
if they were going to do something
this
like
this
at all.
This is not Rome's gift. And the Vatican... the Vatican operates on its own schedule. And this is something,
right.
This is something that's been in the works for a long time. It's, there could be any number of reasons that they ran this out now. There could have been like an opening in someone's schedule. There are a lot of moving parts in Rome. So it's, I wouldn't look at it as a coordinated effort.
No, but if you're thinking, sort of strategically,
right.
In terms of the public perception of what you're doing, it didn't seem well-timed.
No. And so you've got the bishops in the United States, making a strong argument that any private employer should be able to give people free tacos. Wait, no, that wasn't it. What was it? It was any Taco Bell owner could decide not to, give an employee contraception coverage.
Right.
That obviously makes it look like the bishops are pushing to make it, difficult for women to get contraception. And then at the same time, you've got...
Well, they are.
Right. Well, although finally this may backfire. I mean, they've actually ended up giving the Democrats a pretty good fundraising tool.
Well, yeah, definitely. But... Even setting aside electoral politics, how is this being received by Catholics? I mean, I know you posted the Appleby, is that his name? The Notre Dame professor, that interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, in casual conversation with Catholics that I know, I meet people who are just fed up with the bishops trying to impose these beliefs and this doctrine and this orthodoxy on their parish or
sure.
on them.
Although, yeah. Teaching orthodoxy is kind of their job, but it's an open
right,
question.
But in a broader political arena, imposing that orthodoxy and bringing politics into the parish.
Well, and that's where the bishops need to tread very lightly, because Catholics do not respond well to being told how to vote by their pastors. That is just not how it's done. There's no, in the United States, there's not a long tradition of having politicians speak from the pulpit. So anytime you see, and I've seen it in my own parish, you know, when my pastor read the statement from the Bishop of Brooklyn about the HHS mandate, which was actually different from a lot of the other statements that, that bishops put out, you could sort of, I was looking around the church and you could kind of see, this came after, you know, at the end of Mass. And so you could see people kind of, you know, their backs were straightening. They were looking around, you know, trying to see what other people were making of this, because it's very unusual. So, you know, when you note that you're, you know, you're getting this specific policy complaint after Mass at church before, you know, before Mass is over. And then you see this, you know, fortnight for freedom that the Ad Hoc Committee on Religious Freedom is planning. You know, I just, I'm very dubious this is going to go over at the parish level.
Yeah. But what's the, what would be the repercussions? I mean, if it doesn't go over the parish level, what do the, what do the parishioners do? Do they go to their priests and say, I'm not that excited about hearing about this at Mass?
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, pastors are practiced at receiving complaints from parishioners for sure. But yeah, of course. I mean, that would be something. I mean, you could. I mean, people might just not show up at these Fortnite for freedom events, however they take shape. You know, you could see people, you know, voting with their wallets. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to predict. I don't think, you know, I don't think there'll be a mass exodus or anything like that. But and it's also going to be still up to each individual bishop how hard they push. And I don't think there are a lot of bishops who are going to force their pastors, their priests, to preach on this. I mean, even
on this,
even
this
letter,
Fortnight of Freedom
thing
that they're this Fortnight of Freedom that campaign that they're planning for the summer. You mean?
Yeah, I mean, you'll see. You know, there might be public. This could hit with a giant thud. I mean, I just don't know that. I'm dubious that this is going to be an effective campaign. First of all, very few people know what the word Fortnight is. So, but yeah, I mean, it's just political agitation.
And how many people know who Sir Thomas More is? I just am so
fascinated.
I mean,
just the way that it's used in that document, you wonder whether the bishops do. It's not like he, you know, it's not like he had a history of being a champion of religious freedom.
Exactly. See, that's what was so amazing to me. And there was an article somewhere, I can't remember where, or maybe it was just a blog post, which actually took this Reformation analogy even further. And it engaged in this pretense that there was never any Catholic hostility and persecution of Protestants during the Reformation era. It was portrayed entirely as this analogy between the U.S. government of today and Henry VIII trying to impose the Church of England on Catholics in England. And it was just like, it was so over the top that you just could not believe how anybody who had any marginal knowledge of that history would absorb that in any way.
Yeah, it was not, you know, not the finest example of the Bishop's Committee, Bishop Committee's knowledge of religious history. But also,
well,
I mean,
because at the time in England, people who were distributing English language Bibles were burned at the stake. I mean, so, you know, because the Vatican didn't like, you know, what was going on with the Protestant Reformation, not just in Germany, but in England at the time. So,
and this is referred to in the most recent statement in the most hilariously sanitized way. It's like, you know, there have been moments of shadow that have, it's like, well, I mean, it's not like, you know, there's a dark history there. It doesn't mean that the bishops can't make an argument for religious freedom now, but the kind of argument they're making, it's perplexing. So I mean, do I think that the members of the bishops who are on the ad hoc committee are themselves partisans? No, I don't actually. I think they're being sloppy, and I think they're being sloppy in a way that allows their authority to be misused by political partisans. And it doesn't. And I don't. You know, I mean, sure, that obviously, you know, bishops vote. So some of them vote for Republicans, others vote for Democrats, some vote for Independents. Probably a lot right in. You know, it's not that they're apolitical creatures, but in this particular instance, one of the reasons the Commonweal editorialized in strongly, you know, critiquing the bishop's most recent statement was precisely because when you make sloppy arguments, when you seem, you know, intent on driving one particular point as hard as you can for as long as you can, and without acknowledging countervailing arguments, countervailing historical facts, you look like you're not being fair-minded.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other piece of this, to bring it back to the crackdown on the women religious, is that they're complaining, the bishops are complaining that their religious liberty is being infringed upon, yet, and I know this is more of an internal Catholic debate as opposed to a government policy that they say is infringing on their religious freedom, but they're cracking down on the speech and interpretation and practice of Catholicism by these nuns. Like, the nuns do not have any, looking at it from the outside,
sure,
it looks like, you know, the nuns don't have any freedom to express their religious beliefs, that they must fall in line.
Yeah, I would put it that. I mean, and also this is, you know, for good or for ill, you make a promise of obedience, and so this is part, you know, this is part of the structure.
But was there at one time that such dissent and disagreement was more accepted by the Vatican? I mean, because, you know, obviously the current Pope has a reputation for being the enforcer, right? Because he used to head up the
I think he struck
CDF
a different pose as Pope.
As Pope.
And you see this in what the church calls Episcopal Synod. So when Bishop Synod, this was something that Vatican II tried to bring back, meetings of the world's bishops in Rome, you know, kind of sharing of ideas, that sort of thing. Under John Paul II, a lot of bishops complained that it seemed like the agenda and the conclusions were already set before they even met. That hasn't been the case under Benedict. Bishops have been, you know, very open about the fact that it does seem to be a more genuine kind of give and take. But again, you know, no one should be surprised that the current Pope, you know, that people sort of see the way that nuns are being treated now, and they say, well, this is, you know, this is something that we were afraid of when we saw that he was elected.
Right. But I think that a lot of the criticism has come, a lot of the criticism of the Vatican's crackdown on the sisters has been, these are the, like you said at the outset, that these are the people who run, you know, built the hospitals and the schools and the social service agencies and run them. And without them, where would all of that infrastructure be? And who would be the people who carried on that social justice tradition? Yet there's another way to look at it, which is that, you know, so why are they, there's one way to look at it and say, why are they cracking down on these charitable and selfless people? But there's another way to look at it as, you know, why are they so threatened? Would that be the right word? Are they threatened, or are they just being hostile to the variety of interpretation of Catholicism and Catholic doctrine that I think the nuns were probably used to being able to express that at one point in time? I mean, am I wrong about that? I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense of, has this been in the works for a long time? I mean, there's been like feminism and liberation theology, and I mean, has it never been acceptable to the Catholic hierarchy, or is it becoming less acceptable? Is there sort of a shrinking window of where the doctrine can be?
Those are a lot of questions. Let me see. Let me see if I can take some of them up. I think that feminism is certainly and has been and continues to be a preoccupation of certain bishops, certain theologians who are very suspicious of feminism, to the extent that it is seen as a threat to tradition. There, when it came to the Beth Johnson case, what I found in the U.S. bishops' critiques of her work was a kind of willful misreading, a failure to see that her work was not intended to exclude men, but to make more space for women. And so she retrieved from scripture, you know, these feminine images of God. And it's like, you know, some of these guys have like an allergic reaction. You know, they see these, you see someone trying to retrieve these feminine images, and suddenly you think, well, you know, you must want to replace men. That's what this is really about, right? Even though Johnson defended herself very admirably and very persuasively, you know, there was a kind of obstinate attitude from the U.S. Bishops Committee on Doctrine is what produced these critiques, that refused to acknowledge that she didn't see herself as cutting men out of the picture. This was about including women. This was about attending to women's spiritual needs. And, you know, I don't think, when you see, you know, that most recent study of millennials showing that even though 80% of them had been raised in a Christian tradition, that over a period of time, only 60% of them continued to identify as such. Mm-hmm. You know, that I think that kind of attrition, church leaders, you know, it's not just Catholic church leaders, but, you know, all church leaders, you know, that's something that people should be very scared of. And it's very hard for me to believe that these kinds of signals that get sent, regardless of what the intention is, but if the signal is that we bishops are concerned about you know, women having access to contraception, we're concerned that these women religious are too radically feminist. You know, how does that hurt? I don't know to what extent bishops are really thinking, but I don't think, you know, I'm not sure most young Catholic women are going to take that well, especially when you're seen to be going after a group of people who have committed their lives to building up the church.
Well, I mean, do you think that is the goal? Is the goal to make the faith more doctrinally pure, so to speak, or what in the Vatican's mind would be doctrinally pure? And whether, you know, if everyone wants to come along, they can come along, and if they don't like it, they don't have to come along. I mean, do you think?
I think that's certainly the attitude of some bishops, certainly Catholics, certain Catholics. But it's not like there's a game plan. you know, where we go after the nuns and then we go after the liberal lay groups and then we go after the liberal. It's not like that. You've just, I think, to be honest, one of the things that drove this investigation of nuns here in the States was just their dwindling numbers. And that's been something that...
But why would dwindling numbers cause an investigation? Well, dwindling numbers would make them cherish the dwindling numbers that they had left.
Well, yes, and that's certainly, yeah, that would be one of my responses. But but if you look at the number of nuns, I mean, there's something 60,000 left, maybe. And
what's the demographic, the age demographic?
Right,
there?
And that's, and they're
trending
and they're,
old,
yes,
right?
And they're actually having trouble paying for. I mean, it's, you know, they're working as hard as they can with what they have.
Well,
and,
so if you look at it from a, you know, from an outsider's point of view, right? And so as a non-Catholic looking in on this, you would think, well, why would the church want to make their lives miserable at this point? What would be the ultimate, like you said, you don't know if they even realize what their end game is. But if you were thinking of an end game, why would you go after these dwindling numbers and make it seem less hospitable for younger women who might want to take those vows and have that life?
Yeah, I mean, I can't answer that question. But I mean, I don't know how this is going to play out. I mean, it could be... You know, it could be like the supposed ban on gay priests that came out 5 or 6 years ago when there was a document that came out from Rome that seemed to strongly suggest that the church would not ordain gay men. But I don't really know any bishops or I don't know any Catholics who believe that gay men are really being screened out. Because there's
in practice.
Yeah, in practice. And in practice, this report could result in relatively minor changes. This could be... the statutes could be edited in such a way that didn't actually change much about the day-to-day lives of nuns. That doesn't, you know, that doesn't soothe the insult. But it is, you know, when you ask, you know, why would you want to make it harder for young women who are considering this sort of life of service? I mean, the practical consequences could be pretty limited. But that's something, you know, we'll just have to see. There's a lot of unknowns. I mean, this is a big job. They will, you know, the bishop who's been put in charge of this has been given the authority to add staff members. Because, you know, there are lots of communities of women religious who fall under the LCWR.
Right. Well, I guess the other thing that I'm thinking about is my inbox got fairly filled up with press releases from different organizations basically protesting this action by the Vatican. The Conference on Women's Ordination, I think it's called the Women's Ordination Conference. There were some other groups. And then there's a group, Catholics for Equality, which is a pro-gay marriage group, which is starting some kind of social networking campaign to support same-sex marriage among Catholics. Does this have any impact at all on, I mean, does the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops take these sorts of protests by rank-and-file Catholics into account? Does it matter to them, or do they're thinking these are people on the fringes, and we don't need them anyway, or we don't want them?
Well, because... I seriously doubt whether the support of the Women's Ordination Conference or the support of any pro-gay marriage groups is going to redound to the benefit of the sisters who are being investigated. I don't know that it would have a negative impact.
Does it have any impact?
You know, this is radioactive stuff when it comes to bishops. I remember when. Now Cardinal Dolan was elected president of the Bishops' Conference. That was kind of an upset because the tradition of the conference had held that whoever was the vice president for the previous 3 years would be elected. It was almost like automatic. But
right.
What happened was that the guy who was vice president, there was a very organized campaign against him by conservative Catholics who tried to smear him with responsibility in a case of a sexually abusive priest. It was a bogus campaign. I mean, it was ridiculous. I heard that these people were calling the hotel rooms of bishops. Late in that controversy, maybe a day before the ballots were cast, the Rainbow Sash Movement endorsed the bishop who had been vice president. My immediate reaction was, this is going to hurt him.
Because that's
going to make it was absurd. And of course, the Rainbow Sash Movement sent out a press release as soon as he lost and asked for donations. And I mean, you know, so there are some interesting, it's not clear to me that those statements of support help anyone other than the people who are making those statements.
But how else do dissenting Catholics have a say?
Well, obviously, in a country like the United States, you can write whatever you want and say whatever you want. You can make your
right.
You
I mean, within
arguments.
The church, though. I mean, because you know, there are people who are devout Catholics. They want to be Catholic, but they feel like the stances of the church on something like same-sex marriage, to just take that as an example, is antithetical to their own beliefs. So I'm not talking about in terms of how do they have a say in public life, but how do they express their concerns or discontent within their own church and church broadly, as opposed to within their own diocese or parish?
Oh, that's a question for the ages, Sarah. I mean, I think you know, when it, let's take an issue like contraception, a little less contested among Catholics than something like
Right.
gay marriage or women priests. I think most Catholics, the vast majority of Catholics, you know, they know what the Church teaches, and they've come to a kind of internal agreement that that is not as important to them as the Eucharist. I would imagine that that's the kind of model of thinking that most that most Catholics who have serious problems with certain elements of the teaching, I think that's the kind of thought pattern that they would employ in order to, you know, avoid tearing their hair out at church.
Right, but that seems to be a more personal decision, you know, that you've decided that you're still going to go to church and you're still going to use contraception, as opposed to feeling, believing that it's an injustice that gay people can't be married. And you're not gay, but, you know, so it's
Sure.
not like you can do anything, like, you know, like with the contraception example, you can ignore the church teaching on contraception. But it's almost as if with this other issue, you can't ignore it if you feel like it's an injustice.
No, I mean, if this,
How do
yeah,
you...
obviously, if you're in a diocese, I mean, and a lot of this is very personal. I mean, like politics, religion is very personal. If you have a pastor who's going to preach regularly on an issue in a way that you find violates your, you know, your some of your most closely held beliefs, then yeah, I mean, you're probably going to walk out. Or you might find a parish that attends to your spiritual needs in a way that doesn't offend your moral sensibilities.
But is there a parish in America where the priest could be in favor? Could be publicly in favor of same-sex marriage? Is that even possible?
No, maybe you're not. No, probably not. But
I mean, even if he was in his heart, he could not publicly.
I'm sure that. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are priests who disagree with. I mean, because it, if it finally is there's a question of public policy here. It's not. I mean, there may be. I'm sure there are a lot of Catholics who think that. I mean, if you look at the polling numbers, they're right there with the rest of the country. They, you know, by some majority, they support same-sex marriage. But I bet you, if you polled those same Catholics, very high numbers of them would still maintain that the church should not have to bless those kinds of unions.
Sure, but as far as just like a civil, legal
recognition.
But
from the church, it wouldn't be a sacramental.
Right.
Union. I mean, I think that's the kind of when you drill down into the public policy questions, it's not as the, sorry.
But those exemptions for, you know, churches are written into most of the same-sex marriage laws that are being passed in state legislatures.
Right.
They say, you know, no church or religious institution will be forced to recognize or perform a same-sex ceremony.
I mean, I don't think it's totally irrational for church leaders to have serious concerns about the ramifications for their own practice when it comes to you know, laws that are passed that could be construed by courts as human rights. You know, once something gets, you know, elevated to that level, then, you know, how is that going to be adjudicated when it comes to, you know, renting the parish hall, that sort of thing. You know, I don't know any priests who are seriously concerned that they'll be forced by the state to bless same-sex marriages, but I do know priests who wonder how this is going to play out over time. But that's still, you know, it's the question of whether the state should sanction same-sex unions, I think for a lot of Catholics is separate from what the church teaches about marriage, which is not, the church teaches a lot
about
marriage.
Right, but
the church doesn't teach that marriage is woman plus man. I mean, that's not the only thing the church teaches about marriage. There's actually a very long tradition and beautiful tradition of teachings on marriage. And I think that's probably where most Catholics, you know, go when they, in their minds, when they think about what the church has to say about marriage. The problem is
right,
that,
but the yeah,
you know,
the church has injected itself into the public policy debate and not just the
right
an intra-religious debate.
Right, but you know that's which is their right, and that's something that, you know, the church encourages Catholics to be active in public
right.
policy debates.
But do you think the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has a in terms of its lobbying arm in Washington? Do you think that it has an outsized, or maybe that's not the right word, but that the lobbying it does in Washington is not necessarily representative of the views? And people hire lobbyists to argue their case to legislators, right? And it's not like Catholics have signed on to like, yes, I want the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops to lobby on X, Y, and Z for me in Washington. I mean, it doesn't work that way. The bishops decide what they're going to lobby on. And do you think it's representative of the variety of American Catholic thought on the various issues that that the bishops lobby on, which are not, I should point out, limited to the things that make the news a lot?
I mean, I think they come, you know, I don't think they actually have actual lobbyists. They have staff members who go to the Hill and make the pitch. I don't think they have any registered lobbyists who they hire.
They don't have to, though. The Lobbying Disclosure Act exempts them.
Right. You know, I actually think they do, you know, they do cover a pretty broad spectrum. You saw with that series of letters that the bishops released to
on
the
the budget.
House, strongly critiquing the most recent version of the Paul Ryan budget as,
Yeah.
you know, failing a moral test for protecting the most vulnerable. You know, that arm of the bishops' conference is pretty robust, and they're not, you know, they don't necessarily have a lot of contact with the pro-life office, which seems to be very heavily involved in the religious freedom campaign.
Right.
I don't know how the staffing stacks up. I mean, I know that the Religious Freedom Committee has staffed up. I know that at the most recent bishops' conference meeting, they voted to approve an increase in the diocesan tax, which is in part how the bishops' conference is funded, by a tax that's levied against each diocese in order to fund these hires. So, I mean, it would be, yeah. The question here is emphasis, right? So,
mm-hmm.
you know, when Commonweal criticized the way that the bishops are handling the religious freedom campaign, it was about perception. You know, how are people going to view, are Catholics or non-Catholics going to view you bishops as partisans? Now, I think,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think that these recent letters, you know, it doesn't use the same kind of language that you would see in Economic Justice for All, which was the U.S. bishops' pastoral letter on the economy, which I believe came out 25 years ago. I might have that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very strong critique of unfettered capitalism, the kind of capitalism that ignores the poor. You know,
mm-hmm.
you're not seeing as strong of language in this most recent series of letters, but it still is a series of letters, and the bishops have issued a series
of letters. Are the letters that they sent to the congressional committees
That's
about
right.
the Paul Ryan budget.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still relatively strong language. It's stronger language than you saw surrounding the Iraq War, for sure. Even, I mean, it was Rome that was doing more lobbying against that war than
mm-hmm.
the U.S. bishops. So, you know, and I wonder what these are separate committees. So you have to imagine that the committee that issued these letters on the Ryan budget, you know, they recognized that the religious freedom campaign was sucking all the air out of the room,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to shift the conversation a little bit, or at least to say,
yeah.
look, you know, we bishops are not Republicans, we're not Democrats. We don't have a party. We have a range of issues that no single party addresses. Whether it's the death penalty, whether it's poverty, whether it's abortion, whether it's same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is this sort of discussion about the budget issues? I mean, the way that Ryan played that, you know, when he told, and he brought this up last year when his budget was, you know, before it was passed by the House, when he was first proposed, not first proposed, but when it was in the news last year, last spring.
Right.
But then he went into some more detail. I can't remember who he gave the interview in 2011 when he talked about it, but then he went into more detail with David Brody of the
yes.
Christian Broadcasting Network, where he talked about that it was in line with the preferential option for the poor and the Catholic
right.
concept of subsidiarity.
Yes, that was hilarious.
And,
that was totally absurd.
Which is,
it was
you know,
completely
not,
absurd.
Right, but where did he, you know, he did not pull that out of the air, I don't think. I mean, there are
sure.
Catholic thinkers or think tanks, maybe mm-hmm. is a better way to put it, who have been spinning it that way, have been lining themselves up with the sort of small government conservatives and turning this Catholic idea of subsidiarity into an argument for why the government
for federalism,
be,
I believe, is what Paul
yeah.
writes. I mean,
mm-hmm. right.
it's a tricky teaching. I mean, it can work as a Rorschach test, and it's been used by laissez-faire economists to justify, you know, all manner of unfettered capitalism, which, you know, is not something you're going to find a lot of support for in church teaching, especially in papal teaching. But, you know, it's just, Paul Ryan sounds like he's grafting kind of Ayn Randian vision onto Catholic teaching. And then
and maybe if you could just give a little, as short as you
oh,
can,
sure.
description
yeah, I mean,
of what subsidiarity is. It's the idea that the smallest unit in society should be helping at the community level.
It's not just the
maybe
it's not just, it's not just the most local level that should govern. It's the most local it's the most local level that can govern best.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you would see this argument trotted out by people who were opposed to the Affordable Care Act because, you know, there was the fairy tale that was being told that this was a government takeover. And
right.
this violates Catholic teaching because the Catholic Church teaches that it's the most local level that should be. Well, that's
right,
not
the federal government shouldn't be doing it. Right.
And it's the teaching of, you know, the teaching would hold that if the most local level has failed, then you got to move up the chain. But
yeah.
and it can never be held apart from solidarity. So it's not just, you know, it's not just this teaching about how the governing or at what level the governing should take place. It's also about, you know, who are you in solidarity with? And for Christians, that's the poor.
Right. Well, so, you know, you said that it was like Paul Ryan was engrafting Catholic teaching on engrafting Ayn Rand on Catholic teaching. And I felt like he was grafting it with Grover Norquist. It was like he was trying to give the justification for drowning government in the bathtub, you know, making
right.
it so small that you can drown in the bathtub and trying to give some Catholic justification for that, which seemed.
No, and you know, and I, I, I wouldn't argue with that. And I also think it was fascinating to see, you know, he rolls this this argument, this interview out with David Brody. And, you know, then the series of letters from the Bishops' Conference comes out. And then Ryan gives another interview where he tries to minimize those statements as, you know, coming from, you know, not, you know, it's, this is just from a few bishops.
Just a committee. Right.
I mean, that's not really how the Bishops' Conference works. I mean, you can see that the temptation, it's one that I think both liberal Catholics and conservative Catholics fall victim to. You know, you don't want to believe that, you know, your ox is being gored by every single bishop. And it's not entirely false that, you know, there are bishops who would agree with Ryan's budget. But it is false to claim that the bishops who wrote those letters do not represent the wider body of bishops, because they are in fact elected to serve in those roles, to represent the entire body of bishops.
Well, maybe that's a good place to end.
Democracy.
So yeah, this was really fascinating to talk with you about
thanks.
All of this. Thank you very much.
Anytime.
Okay, bye.